Joining us next on the Pot of Gold is a very special guest joining Mike and I. Excuse me a little bit. This is a lengthy introduction. He was the NFL Offensive Rookie of the Year, NFL Comeback Player of the Year, Walter Payton Man of the Year, two-time All-Pro, second-team All-Pro, six-time Pro Bowler. He won the Super Bowl 40 in his hometown of Detroit. Former Notre Dame running back, Jerome Bettis. Jerome, thank you so much for joining Pot of Gold.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it, guys.
Awesome.
How do you like that intro?
I mean, yeah, it was a little lengthy. but no, it was, thing. Yeah. You know what? I'm so blessed, the career that I've had, considering, you know, leaving Notre Dame, I was a fullback. I mean, I never even thought about playing tailback. So to hear all of those things, it's just, it still amazes me because it should have probably never happened.
Jerome, obviously you're back in town. You're back in school. You're going to be graduating soon as a soon to be college graduate. How excited are you about that day?
I am so excited because, you know, obviously it's a culmination of years and years of wanting to get it done and you know, having started something and being able to now complete that task is a big point of emphasis for me. And, you know, having children now, I understand how important that is, that, you know, I set out something, I finish it. But also, to be a college graduate, you know, I want my children to understand how important that is. And I think they do understand the significance now that I've decided to come back after all these years when I didn't really have to come back and actually finish and complete the degree. So I think it means a lot. And you know, my mom, I promised her years ago, sitting in Coach Holt's office, that I would come back and graduate, so I owe that to her as well.
So when you talk about coming back 30 years later, what has been the biggest struggle for you becoming a student once again?
Well, two things. One is the technology. I mean, you know, everybody in my class, they're on computers, and I am literally writing down information because I can't type and all that. So that the technology gap is huge. And then the other part is the study habits. You know, it's just so hard to sit down and open up the book and study as opposed to, let me see what's on television. Because, I mean, my former life, that's what I, you know, you're home, you know, once you make sure the kids are good and you got some downtime, you just turn on TV and just kind of amuse yourself. Well, that just doesn't work in a college setting in terms of you've got responsibilities, you got readings, you got all these classwork to do. You just have to be a little bit more deliberate with your time, and that I struggle in that department.
College students notorious for not getting enough rest. What are your sleep patterns like these days?
And I get it because you find so many other things to do, and you say, oh man, I got to read. I got 15 pages to read, right? And so you got to read, you know, so you find yourself up to 2-3 in the morning. You're like, man, what was I thinking? I had all afternoon and I didn't take advantage of it. So that is definitely me in a nutshell.
So you came here to complete your business degree, right? Mm-hmm. And you are already an entrepreneur, successful, multiple businesses. What's something maybe in your discussions with the professors or some of these other brainiacs on campus that you already find yourself bringing into your business, your CEO world?
Well, for me, it's a couple of things. Like, you know, I have a foresight class that it teaches us to kind of look and project 5, 10, 15 years out in a particular industry, looking at different trends, looking at how governmental issues, how environmental issues, societal issues, how all these things come into play in the business. So it's just, you know, made me think broader from a business perspective, which is incredible, you know, to be able to open my eyes and not just see down the road a mile, but, you know, a couple miles away and in a different city, in a different state, and to look at it from a 30,000-foot perspective as opposed to just when I'm in it.
Jerome, you're obviously with the new generation of the working class that's coming up, mm-hmm. with all these kids, 19, 20-year-olds, do you kind of pick their brains a little bit and maybe try and see what this new generation kind of has to offer and kind of what their vision is for the future, in a sense?
Well, not necessarily picking their brains as much as being engrossed in the process with them, you know, listening to how they think. I have a business ethics class, right? And so you get different perspectives on how they view ethics, how they view these different circumstances, different situations. So you just learn more just by being in the environment with them and seeing how they do things, what they say, and how they look at certain issues. So it's been very enlightening, to say the least.
Was it hard for the bus to come in day one and not be recognized?
I was trying to, but my professor didn't allow that to happen. That was the hard part. They were very the professors, you know, so funny. I was just trying to kind of keep my head down and tucked away, and the first day of class, hey, tell me about, you know, tell me your name, tell me, you know, your class, and tell me something about yourself. And it's like, oh man,
what did you say for something about yourself?
So I think one of the first times I said, you know, I'm Jerome Bettis from Detroit, I'm a senior. And then I think I said something about I'm returning back after 27 years or something, and returning to get my degree, you know. And then it's kind of like you could hear a pin drop. It was like, huh? And so, and then I said, you know, I retired, had NFL career, retired, and coming back to finish my degree. And so then it was like, okay, and then. The next class had to do it. The next class, I was just like, oh, you got to be kidding me. I was just trying to sit in the front, just kind of get out of the way in the corner and just kind of take care of business. But none of the professors allowed me to do that.
There was a movie, I think, probably when you were in high school with Rodney Dangerfield. Yeah. I remember seeing it.
Yeah. It was not that wild. And I was not that obnoxious. Sure, yeah, okay. No, not even. Not even close.
Way more fun. You've actually had just the work.
Right? Yeah, exactly. I had to do the work. I mean, I had some tough classes that I wasn't getting a break. He had a whole system going. He was throwing money around, and he was having a ball. Not quite the same scenario.
So did you do more keg stands your first time around or this time around?
Definitely the first time around. This time around, it was just kind of like, you know what, I'm going to stay away.
There was another, you know, couple of things, life-altering developments here for you. Well, for one, you turned 50 recently, so
yeah,
happy birthday.
Yeah, thank you.
Got to celebrate that with the Notre Dame. That's pretty cool. And of course, that changes the way we go. I'm north of 50.
Yeah,
I know what
yep.
that's like. How did that change? You already had made the decision to come back and finish your degree, but as you're building your businesses and you're looking at the second half of your life, what impact did that have turning 50 while you're here, maybe?
Well, it made me, you know, obviously you look at your mortality and you look at, hey, you know, I'm on the other side. I'm on the back nine of my life.
Says the and, man who yeah. got a 78.
So it's like, you know, I'm making a turn, and now it's time for me to, you know, look at life in a different way. And so it just made me look at everything, put in perspective, and appreciate the moment more. And so I got a chance to really appreciate this time around, you know, going to bingo bouts, going to basketball games, you know, men's and women's. And so just doing a lot of the things that the first time around I didn't get a chance to do. So that's what made it fun.
And then more recently, just about 11 days ago, you lost one of your great mentors, your high school coach, the Hall of Famer, Robert Bob Dozier. And what impact has that already had in terms on, obviously, there's no way to say enough about what that man meant to you, but did he, you know, in some ways literally save your life when you were in high school from looking back at some of the old comments?
Yeah, yeah. He was very instrumental in everything that happened in my high school days. Obviously, you know, I was, you know, all over the place, going off the wrong path, but was a really good athlete, and he recognized that. And I remember coming to the house and talking to my parents and say, hey, if you trust me and give me a chance to work with him, he can be special. And that's what was kind of like that aha moment where it's like, okay, if you say so, I hadn't thought about that much. You know, my goal was to get to college, and he saw more than that. And so convinced me to play running back as opposed to linebacker. That was a big point because I was, you know, a true linebacker mentality wise. I was aggressive. I just wanted to try to, you know, wreck shop and hit people and dominate. And so he just convinced me that I would project a better running back because I wasn't tall. I was only 5'10 and a half at that point. And he knew that my dad was only 5'10 and a half. So he knew I wasn't going to be much taller than that. And so he said, hey, you're going to be a prototypical fullback, but you'll be an undersized linebacker. And those things kind of rang true. And as I started and going to my recruiting trips and that process, I kind of let all the teams know that I wanted to play fullback as opposed to linebacker. And I think I was a better linebacker actually in college than a fullback. But Coach Holtz and Notre Dame, they saw the potential at fullback and said, hey, we will only play you at fullback. We think you can be special, and the rest is history.
Coach Dozier, I've seen there, you said he had like five or six daughters, so they would kind of report back to him what was going on. But
well, not daughters, but he had five or six girls in the school that kind of
report back.
Yeah,
is that how he would have known that you and your brother were really – in some cases, taking your lives into your own
hands. Yeah. He was aware of those things and the neighborhood stuff. And he was, you know, obviously, when your coach has his ears to the ground, he knows quite a bit. So he was able to disseminate the information from all the different channels that he got, and not just myself. I mean, it was a lot of kids that he was able to really, you know, put his arms around and guide in the right direction. So not just myself, it's a lot of guys that have Coach Dozier to thank for what he was able to do for all of us. So, I mean, he was that special of a person.
He was a bona fide legend.
That's right. Yes, he was.
What made you choose to go to Notre Dame?
Well, for me, coming to Notre Dame was about what I looked at initially because education was always important to me, it was, okay, once I have determined the schools that from an educational standpoint I can go to, then I'll look at the football side. So the one school I wanted to go to more than any other school was Oklahoma. Because Oklahoma, they had that wishbone and the fullback, and they had a guy when I was coming up, I watched, his name was Kenyon Rashid. He was a fullback, and he was just pounding. And so I was like watching this guy saying, okay, I can do that. Right. And my dad, God rest his soul, he said, son, you know, Oklahoma's out, because there was one kid that was from Detroit that just went to jail. At Oklahoma, and they went on probation and all this. And he said, no way I'm sending you to Oklahoma. Right. So I was like, I was crushed. So then I had to try to figure out where am I going, after that. And so, that's when I started to open it up and look at the different opportunities. It came down to the three schools that I visited. I visited Notre Dame, I visited Michigan, and I went out and visited USC. Those were the three visits I took. All great from an educational standpoint. So it came down to on the field. And of those three teams, the Notre Dame's system best fit me individually as a fullback, because it gave me the ability to run the ball, catch the ball, and block, which the other schools didn't quite allow the fullback that much freedom. So it was a no-brainer once I started to look at the position that I was going
to
play.
What did it mean to play for Lou Holtz?
Oh, he was incredible. He has been a rock in terms of my career and how I was able to transition from college to the NFL. He kind of taught me the work ethic and what I needed to be great every day, not just in football. And so coach was great because he taught life lessons, not necessarily football lessons. He taught it in a football backdrop. He used football as the backdrop, right? But those messages were life lessons that he was teaching. And you know, if you received it, then you were better for it. And so he was spectacular in how he motivated us and how he kept us going. I mean, everybody has stories about, you know, their interaction with Coach Oates. Everybody's interaction was different, but that's what made him so special.
The Snow Bowl, I have to ask you about that against Penn State. When you guys get down to fourth down and
yeah.
what's going through your mind when that it's fourth down? You guys are facing basically do or die.
Yeah.
They call your number.
Yeah, it was like, okay, we got to make it happen. And you get in that moment and you don't worry about catching the ball, doing this. You just know that, hey, this is the play. It's gonna work, right? It's like, yeah, that's it. I'm going to sneak out and I'll be ready, right? And so it's just one of those, Rick called it, and, you know, we look at each other, got it, okay. And, you know, I got to be there for him. And so they call the play, and I sneak out, boom, get up, and he gets it to me, and you know, I catch it. And that was a special moment because obviously you know, the coaches trust that you're going to come through. They're going to call your number. You're going to make the play, right? And a lot of times, you know, you call plays and things happen. He like, you know, he busted for a big run, right? But you maybe call the play not expecting to get a touchdown, but you call the play thinking you're going to get a big play. It becomes a touchdown. Well, here we were, fourth down. We got to have a touchdown, right, to have a chance to even tie the game or win the game. So it's like fourth down, this is it, last call, and when coach makes that call, it's the confidence that is in he instills in you is that, hey, I believe this is the play, right? Because down in there, you don't have really a plan B, you know, that's the play. So to have him call it and for me to be the guy that he's counting on, it meant a lot because, you know, it just meant that he believed in me.
Craziest part is the 2-point conversion.
Well, the crazy part is that he actually went for two.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
Decided to go for two because we're at home and, you know, we can get the tie and it's not going to, you know, hurt us because both teams were really good. You know, Penn State was a really good team.
You're split out at receiver.
Yeah. So
how many times in your career have you been split out at
a couple times, actually, right? if you could believe it or not. But, you know, he was trying to throw the defense off, and it's like, okay.
And then Brooks hadn't made, like, he'd only caught, like, two or three passes in his career.
Yeah, everybody.
And he makes that grab.
Everybody's like, he's got hands of stones, right? It's like, you're not throwing it to him, are you? No! And it's one of those, you see it, you're like, no! Yeah! So that was one of a magical moment. And Reggie, that's, you know, obviously I would think one of the biggest plays that he ever made here at Notre Dame. I can think about some runs against USC that he made, which was spectacular, but that was a special moment.
Who did the best Lou Holtz imitation on those teams?
Oh man, that's a good question. Well, actually, nobody. 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 Yeah, nobody even. Because we thought he could. We knew he could hear through walls. So So nobody even thought about imitating him. And
what do you have today? 30 years later. Give us your best.
He probably won't hear this. See, so I'm gonna get a phone call, right? So you're gonna get me in trouble because he will hear it. I mean, I'm just telling you, he's incredible, and you get a phone call, and it feels like 30 years ago when you get the phone call. He called me not too long ago and congratulated me for coming back to school, and I was as nervous as ever. And I've seen Coach, you know, 50 times since then. It's every time. It's Jerome, Hey, coach. You know the voice, right? It's like, I just want to, you know, congratulate you. Like, thanks, coach. I appreciate it, right? It's like, you're on pins and needles, man. I mean, but that's the respect that he commands. And every player, I think, really appreciates him and what he's done for all of us. So, but I'll tell you this, he still strikes fear in all of the former players. We still love him.
Nobody used a lisp more effectively.
Nobody
to gain power.
That's right.
In a career,
that's right. He did
turn into a positive.
Jerome, you got off to a quick start in the NFL. Mm-hmm. What made it click? I mean, you had obviously a strong career at Notre Dame, but you get to the NFL, you're with the Rams. How were you able to get it really going so quickly, especially as a rookie?
Well, I was fortunate enough to go to a coach who wanted to run the football, and he believed in big running backs. He had big running backs before, so
ground chuck.
So it wasn't like out of the ordinary for him or what he wanted to do. That was what he wanted to do. That was his game plan. So for me to come in and fit right in, I was able to kind of go. Now, I had a huge learning curve because other than, you know, the few times I played tailback at Notre Dame, I remember one game, coach, we had a couple guys get hurt. And coach decided to move me to tailback instead of letting some of the freshmen running backs play. He hated giving the ball to freshmen. So he said, Jerome, you're going to play tailback this game. And I'm like, coach, I've never played tailback ever. He's like, no, you can do it. No problem. You just got to learn the plays. It's like, oh, okay, just learn the plays, right? And that week, I became a tailback, and so in that game, you know, I think it was Air Force at home, and I think I had like 130, 40 yards. And then after that, he saw I could play it, so at the end of every game going forward, I would kind of finish off the game. And so that gave me the confidence to believe I can do it, but I still didn't have the raw skill set that most tailbacks have, you know, spin move, stiff arm, those kind of things. I didn't have any of that. So when I got to the NFL, it was just like a learning curve. I had to kind of figure some of that stuff out. All while I had a fullback's mentality. So if I saw the linebacker, I would rather hit the linebacker than try to outrun the linebacker, right? Because I'm thinking as a fullback, yeah, pound, pound, pound. So I had to change my whole mentality in terms of get the most yards for the team, not try to punish the guy as much as you can, you know. So it was a whole different mindset. So I had to learn that. That was probably bigger than anything else physically. It was learning how to make people miss and learning how to, you know, spin off of somebody or bounce off of somebody and keep your balance and all those things that tailbacks learn as kids coming up. Those are things that I had to learn kind of on the field.
Rich Brooks comes in, and you guys kind of don't see eye to eye on your future with the Rams, and you decide to you get traded. Mm-hmm. By Pittsburgh.
Well, it came down, you know, the Rams gave me the ability to go seek a trade. Mm-hmm. And it came down to two teams who were really interested, and it was at the time, the Houston Oilers, and it was the Pittsburgh Steelers. Both teams were really interested. And then it just really came down to the Steelers had just lost in the Super Bowl. And so they were, you know, Super Bowl caliber team. And they also had a history of big running backs. So I just knew that was the perfect place for me. Now, although Houston had his history of running backs, I just thought Pittsburgh, because they just came off of a championship run and they lost in the Super Bowl, that they were the better football team in terms of giving me the opportunity. And I think I was right because of the career, how it turned out. But I will say, I think it would have been fairly similar because the player that the Houston Oilers took was Eddie George in the draft that year. So it was either going to be me or Eddie going to either one of those teams. So I like to think it would have been successful though, because Eddie had an incredible career in Tennessee.
So 2005, Big Ben's a rookie. You guys are 15-1. You guys go 15-1. You had considered retiring. And after everything that happens, you guys get bounced out in the playoffs and everything. Yeah. Now, there was said to us that Big Ben and other guys came to you and said, give us one more year to come back and we'll get you to a Super Bowl, especially with it being in Detroit the next year and everything. Just what was that like to see your teammates want to propel you to and get you to that final, to that final stepping stone that you were missing in your career, which is a Super Bowl ring?
Yeah, it was incredible. It was Ben only. He came to me. We were on the sideline and I'm on my knee looking at the game and tears coming down my eyes. And Ben said, hey, you know, just give me one more year. I promise I'll get you to the Super Bowl. And, you know, you hear he's a rookie. You're like, okay, whatever. And so you just think it's in the moment. And so some reflection and some time went on. And I went to the Pro Bowl in Hawaii that year because I was an alternate and one of the running backs broke his ribs in the Super Bowl. And so at that point, I said, you know what? I'll go. Well, come to find out, the Steelers, since we lost in the AFC Championship game, the coaches were there, and we had 8 or 9 players there, and those players bought players. So we had 20-some players, the owners, the coaches, everybody. And there, they convinced me to come back for another year. And so, you know, it made sense. It came back. And then at the end of each game in the playoffs that next year, Ben gave me the game ball every time. I promise I'll get you there. I promise. And so after we won the Super Bowl, he gave me the game ball, and he said, I promise you I'll get you a championship, man. It was a promise well delivered.
But it almost didn't happen.
Almost, because almost didn't.
I need to ask you about that, and I've always wanted to ask you about that play in Indy where you guys are getting ready to punch it in. Win the game, you guys are going, moving on.
Mm-hmm.
Gary Brackett just has a good hit on you. The ball pops out, and then obviously Big Ben's able to make the big tackle. But what was going through your mind during that whole sequence of you fumble the football and everything leading up to Vander Jack missing that field goal?
So clearly you remember it very, very vividly. Yeah. It sounds to me that you were an Indianapolis Colts fan.
I know we're in Indiana. I'm from San Diego.
I'm just joking. I've always been a huge Bucs fan. It just sounded so clear in my memory because I tried to block it out of my memory and I forgot all those moments.
But it's a beautiful
thing. You brought them all back.
It's a beautiful thing, though, if you think about it.
No, it's not.
It's nostalgia. No. It's something. It made the story even better.
No, made it stink. No. I fumbled. I understand what you're saying. And just nostalgia. It sounds good, but as a football player, it stinks because I fumble. I'm like, I can't believe it. So I'm always reminded that I fumbled. Like, no, that moment. If I could erase that moment, I would love to. And we just win. Right, we just won. But no, you're right. It did.
When you saw the movie,
it bring
right,
the moment.
Incredible. Kurt Warner got one.
You're right. And so, it's just one of those. It's one of those moments where you're like, oh, you know, obviously, you know, you hate that moment because you fumble, but you know. Obviously, the play that ensued, Ben making a big tackle and all that happened. But, you know, in that moment, you know, I'm just thinking, hey, I'm going to get this touchdown. We're going to ice the game away. It's the end of it. And, you know, you get down there on the 1 yard line and boop, you know, it pops up and then it's like so everything is slow motion. Ben, oh, yeah, he's always going to be on my Christmas list. For that. So it's like, you know, a special, special bond because he was able to kind of just make it happen for me, which was really special.
What I was amazed by in doing the research on that one, that's known as the heart attack fumble. Super fan Terry O'Neill sitting in the bar watching the game, and he was so shocked that happened. The poor man had a heart attack.
Sure did.
And he survived it.
Yeah.
Did you ever meet
Terry? I did. I did a TV show. He was doing well. Got a chance to meet him.
I
couldn't believe it. Yeah. Well, no, I mean, it was dangerous. Yeah, right? I almost died. Right, exactly. It's like, but he was okay, and hopefully that you find something to help prevent something bigger from happening later. So hopefully that was the that was a blessing in disguise.
Kind of the football point of that is, and looking back, you know, early in your career, the first five seasons, 26 fumbles were credited to you, but then you've seemed to fix it because the rest of your career, only 15 total fumbles. And you know, guys get a reputation as a fumbler or whatever. You're always a tough guy. You were certainly looking for contact. That had to be part of it. The play was never really over. They were ripping it out. But how did you go from being a guy where that was a concern maybe season to season to where it was unthinkable to the point that a man had a heart attack when it happened?
You know what? That's a good question. And nowhere in there did I ever, you know, look at it from that perspective. I don't know. I mean, it just was never, I think the amount of carries that I was getting at that point, I think it was one of those where you kind of look at it and you say, okay, well, it's still, the ratio wasn't bad. So it was never brought up. So it was never really a issue for me in terms of the perception. It was like, oh, this guy's a fumbler. That was never the perception, so there was never a thought that, you know what, I gotta do a better job or I gotta do this. So that's a good question. I mean, until you say it, I didn't even know. I didn't even know that. I never knew how many fumbles I ever had. So that, you telling me that? For that? Yeah, I know, right?
Yeah, he should.
I know. What kind of statistician do we have here?
I said one little thing and I got it.
Why are we focusing on fumbles? No, no, no. You brought it up, though, so it's your fault. You led him to that. Your fault. I'm blaming you. Still blaming you. He's following your lead. It's BS. I'm telling you.
Make up for it here. I want to wish you a happy anniversary of the trade. And it's amazing to me that it happened on April 20th, 1996.
Yeah.
And April 20th become like a national holiday.
That's right. That's right.
And but on that day, you helped decide where you were helping broker the trade. You and your agent, but this doesn't seem like a fair return. The Steelers really held him up.
Yeah.
You get Jerome Bettis and a third-round pick, and all you got to give up is a second-round pick and a fourth-round pick, and that became Ernie Conwell and Jerome Daniels. So, wow, what was your reaction when your value was reduced to something on paper, finally? I mean, because you knew what your value was, but then that's the – I mean,
So at that point, you know, obviously having a down year, you understood the dynamic at play. The thought out there was that, okay, well, he was, you know, he had a bright spot, and now that, you know, he is what he is, he's not any good anymore. But nobody understood the dynamic that was in place in terms of the team deciding just not to play me, right? The coach, he had a thing about me and didn't want to play me. And so at that point, other teams probably looked at it and said, okay, well, clearly it's a problem, right? You're not going to not play a really good, talented football player. But that was a choice that the coach made. And so the Steelers saw that potential and said, oh, we got an opportunity here right. And it was a situation where everybody knew that they had to get rid of me because everyone knew that the Rams were drafting Lawrence Phillips. So right. So they knew that they were drafting a running back, much like the situation right now with a quarterback in Cleveland, I'll say. A similar situation where they know, okay, you got to get rid of them. And so the value wasn't as high as it probably, you know, could have been, but I don't think the value should have been. I think that was pretty fair for what had happened in my career. I went to two Pro Bowls, but the first year, big year, the second year tapered off a little bit. And then the third year, it fell apart. And that was part of the equation.
The idea of Rich Brooks being such a pivotal figure in your career. And then you spent all this time around the Notre Dame staff and looking through it. I thought so. Jared Parker, the tight end coach, was one of Rich Brooks' best players when he went back and coached at Kentucky. Jared Parker was the star receiver at Kentucky when Rich Brooks went back to the college level after all those years at Oregon. In fact, he gave Jared his first job on a college staff. He was a GA in 2007.
Oh, wow.
Before you leave town and leave that building, you might just talk it out there with Jared, and maybe he'll know which Brooks was a pivotal figure in his life in the, to the good, you know. Everybody's got.
I might have an analytics position for you. I mean, you're pretty good. You can dig down in some data. I'm telling you, wow. Wait, so you know, he can connect some dots.
If he's getting a job, what job would I get?
Yeah, you get fired. You get fired. You get fired.
There's room for everybody. Jerome, obviously Thursday is a big deal. It's the NFL draft. Mm-hmm. There's so much around it, so much. I mean, before it was just like a whatever event. Now it's a whole thing. It's in Vegas. Kyle Hamilton is in this year's draft. I know you've talked to him, and you've kind of have you kind of talked to him through what this moment is going to be like, and take us back. What is he going through right now? What is he thinking? What is kind of going back from your memories? What do you think?
Yeah. Now is the excitement. It's like, okay, all the work is done. All the training is done. Now, you know, where am I going to go? It could go anywhere. You know, he can go anywhere from, you know, who knows? First four, five picks down to maybe 15, right? So he can go any of that range. And when he looks at it, he's looking at it saying, hey, okay, well, look at this city, this city, this city. So it's a fun time for him because he knows that he's going to be drafted. He's going to be playing on the next level. And that's a dream for all of those players. I mean, that's the goal, is to get to the NFL. And so he knows that it's close, right? It's right there. And got a chance to talk to him. And hopefully I was able to convince in him that the need to come back and finish. And that's, for me, that's the important part, because Even if he does have an incredible career, right? Let's say he plays 12 years, has an amazing career. He's still only 33, 34 years old. And so the degree from Notre Dame will mean something, right? And he'll be able to utilize that. So that's why, you know, I'm hoping that the things that I'm able to do now inspire some of these guys to want to maybe come back. Kyron Williams, who's leaving as well as an underclassman, maybe he'll want to say, you know what, I want to come back and I want to finish because it's that important. So hopefully
Marcus said that when he heard that you were on campus, that he's like, hey, I need to get this guy over here and give these guys a talk and everything.
Yeah.
And it seems like you kind of taken a leadership role with, and in a sense, like helping out the team, talking to the team and everything, but just what does it mean to have the head coach wanting you in there and wanting you to help? And two, what are some of the cool aspects it's been to reunite with this team, with this young team and all these young players?
So for me, it's been great because obviously when coach says, hey, you know, I want you to come, you know, be a part of the program, it's special because you get a chance to help influence these young men. And to be able to, you know, have those conversations, you know, tell coach, hey, what I remember, what I did or what would help. With the guys, the former players, those kind of things. It's being an advocate in the room. That's the important part, being able to give a different perspective, right? And so that's been incredible. But also to be able to talk to these young guys, give them a perspective, understanding a little bit of paying it forward. You know, some of the things that was taught to me by Coach Holtz in terms of how your work ethic needs to be, how do you go out and how do you approach things? And then things that I've learned throughout my career, now I can impart that information to these guys, right? And explain to them how, you know, one guy on a team can make a difference, right? Explaining that and being able to kind of help possibly motivate those guys to go on and do special things, but also help build the camaraderie that you have to have from a team basis. And so help that environment grow, right? And that's important.
297 former players came back over the weekend, and everyone was just amazed by the legacy weekend. Hunter Biven helped them put that together. But I wonder, in the conversations with all those guys, in the golf and the dinners, how many of them maybe saw that you were back here and, you know, just thought, boy, it looks like, you know, that's a pretty cool thing, and we want to get back, just kind of planted that seed. That do you think that got it rolling. And then why do you think it took so long for that kind of influx of return to happen?
Well, I think it starts with the leadership. I mean, you see Coach Freeman wanting to reconnect with the former players, understanding that it's important to kind of, you know, reactivate those guys, right? And so I think it is an incredible thing. I think it will pay dividends down the road. Obviously, you look at former players and you got to ask yourself, well, you know, who has a high likelihood of parenting a great player? Well, a former great player, right? Makes sense, right?
It makes sense, right?
So if you now include you know, that former player and not make him feel alienated, then now all of a sudden, then now my child would maybe consider going to school here, right? And so I got a 15-year-old, you know, a wide receiver, 6'2" and a half, and I mean 15 years old, right? So it's like, okay, now me coming back here, him seeing the university, because, you know, we live in Atlanta, so he's Georgia and he's Alabama, he's watching all these schools, but I'm bringing him back here, showing him university, and all of a sudden now he's looking at Notre Dame saying, oh man, Notre Dame's pretty cool. Well, that doesn't happen if I'm not back here, right? Not just me. I'm just saying, use me as an example. If I wasn't going to school here and if there wasn't any interaction here, then it's probably no reason for him to be looking at Notre Dame saying, hey, I like Notre Dame. And I can't speak to it because I'm not a part of the program. I'm not being invited back. They're not doing anything in terms of just keeping me activated. So why would I suggest to him to come to my or alma mater who does not reach out to me, right? Did not even acknowledge me. So I think that was a great thing that they did, and it's going to pay dividends down the road. And it's going to keep that Notre Dame tradition of players, great players, and throughout all these different decades, it brings them all together, and we're all family.
4 for 40 really, yeah, takes on a full team there. There's another young man who's closer to his decision than your son is, and that's from Detroit, Dante Moore, mm-hmm. who people talk about a lot.
Yeah.
Quarterback, he was on campus with his dad recently while you were here, and I wondered if you had a chance to meet him.
I did. I was it's so crazy. I was in there, and I was just, it's crazy how things happen. So I come in there, and I am going into, because I've been working out over at the facility. So I come in, I'm in the nothing yet. I'm still working on it. Mind and body, But so I'm in there about to work out, and I come out of the locker room, and one of the coaches says, "Oh yeah, you're a guy from Detroit is here, something or that." I'm like, oh. So then I walk in, and I just got a chance to chat with him. I didn't talk long, but just got a chance to say hello and how you doing, and me and his dad really kind of hit it off because obviously closer to the same age and talking about Detroit back in the day, so that was good. But yeah, he is, from what I understand, a special player and could really change the landscape if we can get him to come to Notre Dame.
And we're in the era of NIL and other guys out there. You know, well, first of all, when you think back, when NIL we talk about now, what would have been the starting rate for some of you guys? You guys had four guys in the top 20 picks in 93. You know, you talk about Meyer and Smith and yourself. My goodness. I mean, if NIL, are you just born ahead of your time or what?
It's okay.
Are you troubled at all by the NIL?
Not at all. Understand it.
Make us feel better about where that's going.
Well, it's the nature of the business now. I mean, it is a business, right? You only got to understand that. And if it is a business, then obviously there's going to be business decisions that have to be made, and there's going to be money that's made because of that business, right? We already know that it's a multi-billion-dollar industry. Well, the problem is the only person benefiting is the university and the coaches, right? So if you're saying the numbers are in the billions, right, who's getting the billions, right? So is there any tricky, is it triculating down to the players? No. Has it been? Well, it needs to.
Not above the table.
Above the table, it needs to be that. Now, here's the other thing. It's not necessarily going to be about the concern is, okay, it's a pay-to-play scenario. And it's not necessarily a pay-to-play scenario because if you don't play, you're not going to get any money, right? They're not going to give you money just to be there. So this is a situation where you're going to get paid for because of your value and what your contributions are. And yeah, so always, like in any business, that the initial investment is always more than what you get because you're projecting what somebody's going to do, right? And somebody get a new job, they get a signing bonus, right? To go to this firm, right? So, but that firm doesn't know that person could be washout, right? You don't know. That person couldn't be the next president. You don't know. So you're paying on expectation, right? So you give them a signing bonus. It's the same thing as a freshman coming in. They're going to get the signing bonus. But guess what? If in year two, if they don't produce, guess what? They're not getting that same number. So it's not people see, oh, this guy's going to get, you know, $8 million. No, the first year that deal is going to be what we're projecting. That next year is going to be what you do.
Better not go spend it all.
That's right. And it's what you do because you understand and that can go away. And people see the numbers. They don't understand the fine print. They don't understand the contract itself, right? It's not a 100% guarantee. If I'm here, this is what I get. That's not the case. You saw the one kid who left Ohio State, went to Texas. He had $1 million NIL deal in Ohio State. That didn't follow him. He didn't get that money because he didn't play. So it's not what people think it is. You hear the big numbers and you say, "Wow, this is." But it's like anything else. It's performance based.
And Notre Dame's aspect of this, doing it in a responsible way, they would like, and you would like to think, with Mendoza piece and you being embedded in the Mendoza realm now, and all the conversations that may have already gone on just in the months that you've been here. Mm-hmm. How confident are you as we approach the first anniversary of NIL? That Notre Dame will lead the way, do it competitively, but responsibly.
I don't know if they're going to lead the way because I think right. How it should be done. Mission. Right.
They're not going to lead the way raw numbers.
No, right. They won't lead the way raw numbers, but I think there will be, you know, there'll be a concentrated effort to really do the right thing in terms of what's fair and not exploit any party in the process. I think that's an important part of it. So the university is very conscious about it. They're I don't believe the university is going to be hands-on at all. They're not going to be involved in any of that. But they do want to monitor and pay attention and make sure that everything is done, like you said, the correct way. So I 100% believe that the university is going to find the right way to do this in a manner in such that is respectful of the player, respectful of the university, and respectful of the game itself.
So in a couple of weeks, you're going to walk across the stage and turn and show that you graduated. What kind of an intro do you want them to give you? I mean, do you want like what I just did for you, or it's like Super Bowl champion, this, that, or just normal Jerome Bettis, that's it? What kind of intro do you want?
Just student. Yeah, just normal. That's all. Yeah. I'm a student. I'm getting my degree, and that's all I want. And I want to, you know, I just want to enjoy that moment, just like every other graduate, right? Just have it in hand, cap and gown, boom. That's all. That's all. I don't want any more accolade because I did no more, no less than any other graduate there. So I don't want this to be a moment, a career moment or anything. No, this is about an accomplishment that was completed, just like everybody else completed it. And that's all I'm asking for.
What's next for the bus? I mean, I've seen you in the office, in the neighborhood. I've seen you act. Is there something you want to do after that? Do you want to continue acting, or what's next for you after graduation?
You know what? That's a great question, and I'm I'm looking at the process. I'm looking at possibly opportunity in an investment world, and really maybe starting a small company and looking into doing some small investing in that way and seeing where that goes. I'm open to the possibilities now, where if you would have talked to me a year ago, probably not. But now I see some opportunities from not only what I've learned, some opportunities that's been presented to me that I think I want to look at and take advantage of.
Well, Jerome, we don't want to abuse your time. Thank you from the Stockroom East and South Bend. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you so much for joining Pot and Gold. And hopefully this isn't the only time we have you on. Hopefully
right,
this
right.
season you can jump on and give us your take on how the team's doing and how everything's going.
Well, thank you. Thanks, guys. I appreciate it. It was a great time, so I appreciate you.